Welcome to Anthony Plogon Music. This is Eddie Ludema, the show's producer, here to introduce Tony's guest for this interview, Kevin Mace. Kevin is the trumpet instructor, department chair, and also the director of the wind ensemble at Riverside City College. Even though Riverside is a two-year college, what Kevin has been able to accomplish has been incredible. His wind ensemble not only performs major works, but it also has a vibrant commissioning program, brings in world-class soloists, and performs to sold-out, standing-room-only audiences. So who better to ask about some insights into building a thriving college program than Kevin? Tony and Kevin began with a discussion of a concert that Tony was involved in as a commissioned composer, where a piece of his was premiered by principal trumpet of the LA Philharmonic, Tom Hooton, along with the RCC Wind Ensemble. Tony and Kevin used this concert to do a deep dive into how Kevin's been able to create such a strong program. Then they get into Kevin's early trumpet studies, how he gradually got into conducting, his being hired at RCC, and eventually becoming department chair.
So Kevin Mace, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Tony. Great to be here.
I'd like to start with a recent experience we had, I guess just about a month ago, because I think it shows so many aspects of the way you conduct the program at Riverside City College. Riverside City College being a two-year college, not a four-year college, just like a junior college in California. And this recent experience was you had commissioned me or led a consortium to write a piece for trumpet and wind ensemble. And the soloist was Tom Hooton of the LA Philharmonic, principal trumpet of the LA Philharmonic. And in addition to the commission and having this great soloist, you also had more than a sold-out hall. You had people literally standing in the aisles, on both sides of the aisle. So I'd like to start with that because it explains a lot about what you've done, and then we can go back and talk about how you got there, because I think it's a really great example of what somebody can do if they're really inspired to make a great program. So the first thing is you got Tom Hooton as your soloist. Normally, a city college or a junior college does not have a soloist of that caliber, and quite often a four-year college doesn't either. So you've had other great soloists in the past, and I think Tom has played a number of times with you. Could you talk about how you've gotten the soloist, and also I think it costs money to bring these soloists in, how you go about that?
Sure. I would suspect that the reason that other universities or colleges don't have great soloists is they just don't ask. I'm a firm believer that you just need to ask. The worst they can do is say no. And like you said, we've had the very great fortune of having other great soloists. Harvey Patel, we did a saxophone. We commissioned a saxophone piece last year, and Harvey Patel played for us. He's played for us a number of times. Vince Timartino has been out. Bob Mincer actually wrote a piece for wind ensemble and saxophone, and he's been out. And I literally just reached out to these people. I didn't know Mr. Mincer, but I knew Vince, and I've worked with Tom a little bit. So I just reached out and asked them, and they were gracious enough to say yes. So, and as far as the funding, it's just a matter of finding the funds. We have a couple of different funding streams, and some years we have a little bit extra and some we don't. And this year I was able to find a little bit extra for this big project.
And are the funding streams for the entire school, or are you responsible for getting the funding streams? How does that work?
We're kind of a little bit of both. The district is very generous with a district budget most of the time. We've gone through some financial issues when the state has financial issues, but for the most part, they're very supportive. And then we do have some extra funding streams. We have a funding stream from our associated students, so we get a small amount from them. And then we're able to keep our box office sales. So like you said, we had a sold-out audience. Our hall is just short of 500, 460. So we sold that out. So we get to keep that money. And even at $10 a ticket, that's roughly $4,500. So that helps a lot. So, and I do five or six concerts like this a year, and at least four of them sell out. The others we have 200 or so. So that's a substantial amount of money. That's more than $10,000 to $12,000 a year just in box office sales that I have access to do projects like this.
And in terms of commissions, You've also commissioned, you talked about some people you've commissioned, and you're commissioning, I think it's Adam Schoenberg, for a
That's
future
correct.
Project. Maybe you could talk about that, because that sounds like a really interesting project and pretty novel also.
Sure. I was part of a big consortium with Adam, oh my gosh, 4 or 5 years ago, maybe even earlier than that. Two of our friends here in Southern California, Ricky Badua and John Burdett. Ricky teaches at Cal Poly Pomona, and John teaches at Azusa Pacific University. They put a very large consortium together. They call it the California Consortium. And we commissioned Adam Schoenberg to write a piece called Rise. And it was purposely not going to be a big, very difficult symphony that Adam usually writes. And so it was going to be more accessible to younger groups, perhaps high school groups and smaller ensembles. And so I got to know Adam through that project. And I decided that we have, I was just thinking that we need more accessible music. Music is graded. Sometimes it's 1 through 6 or A through F or something. But a grade 3 would be kind of a medium high school piece with limited ranges and limited solos, maybe in the double reeds or some of the instruments that are more scarce for smaller programs, or even, you know, some larger. I mean, double reeds and horns are usually the shortage of instruments in smaller programs. And so I had talked to Adam about writing a piece, a grade 3 piece, and we're going to have South Point Middle School, which is an amazing middle school here in Southern California, and its director is an alumni of RCC, Susan Wilmering, who does a terrific job. And they're actually going to do the premiere, and she and I are going to mostly fund the piece, and then we're going to send out some invitations to start a consortium to help us defray some of the cost of Adam's commissioning piece.
And the idea being that the literature for that age of player is normally, you said, not very good, and this is really adding a major composer to that.
I think there's just, I don't want to say that it's not good. It's just, it's not the type of music that I would want to program. So I'm hoping to just expand the grade 3 and get more substantial literature of that level, so that ensembles of that size or that ability have more to choose from.
Well, it was interesting how this project came about that I was commissioned for. And that was about a year ago, I guess. I was at Riverside City College just to do a master class. And I talked to one of your other classes. Or I talked to the wind ensemble, I think. And we were talking, and we had sort of talked about a piece for, I think, chorus and wind ensemble. And we met your choral director, who I got the impression maybe was not overwhelmed with the idea, but in any case, I think it was the next day, I got an email from you saying, okay, Tom Hooton's in, we're going to do a piece for trumpet and wind ensemble. It happened that fast. And I was amazed, you know, that you could make something come about that quickly. And that goes back to your just asking. And then I was talking to Tom once I think pretty much I had finished the piece and sent it to him, and we were talking about changes I could make in the piece. And he said, you know, we should record this. And I thought, well, okay, you know, that costs money, but okay. And, you know, probably not going to happen, but sure, that'd be great. And then a day later, I think I get an email from you saying, we've got a double session on Friday. So you must ask really well. How do you go about that? Do you have a particular formula for how you ask?
No, I just move quickly. With Tom, it was because we've become friends over the years. It was literally a text. It wasn't an email. It was a text. Hey, Tom, how you doing? What do you think about this project? And he was like, I'm in. I mean, it was that fast. And sometimes I maybe work too fast, but I tend to try to get things like on the schedule, and then I figure out logistics later. And I know one of these days is probably going to nip me, but I tend to like, okay, we're going to do it. This is going to be great. And then I hang up the phone and I go, okay, how am I going to pay for it? How am I going to do this? So, but with Tom, it was literally a text. Of course, he knew who you were, and a chance to play he loves doing premieres. I knew that from previous conversations, and it was just going to be a matter for me. I didn't think you would say no. I just didn't know if you would have the time, because being principal trumpet in a major orchestra, finding time to do projects like this may be tough. So that was my only concern. I wasn't concerned about whether he would say yes or no, just whether he could fit into his schedule or not, and our schedule. It was interesting that when he accepted, and now it's like, okay, when are we going to do the premiere? So I'm looking at our calendar, and then I literally would put our calendar up against the Philharmonic calendar and say, okay, well, our concert in October, they're doing pictures. Okay, he's not going to be able to miss that. And on our concert, they're doing Chike 5. He's probably going to not want to miss that. And so originally, I think on the calendar, the Philharmonic calendar, in this March spot, they were originally doing Mozart or something. And I said, well, maybe he'll be able to miss that. And they ended up programming West Side Story. And so he had to take the whole week off and miss West Side Story. But he still agreed to do that because he had committed to us. So it was really, really nice of him to do that.
So you're great at asking. How do you react, or does it happen very often that you get turned down, that people say, no, I'm not interested, or it's just a small college, or I just don't have time, whatever? Is that just part of what you have to accept as your job?
I've only had one person tell me no.
Really?
And he's told us no a number of times, and I don't want to make it a negative thing. It's just he's too busy, and it's Dan Higgins, the great woodwind player here in Los Angeles, and he was always been. I don't know him very well. I just know him from reputation, but he has heard from his colleagues about the great work we do in Riverside, and so we wanted him to come out and play with our ensembles, and he's said no only because he doesn't want to. He's afraid that he would get a film score call or something that he would have to bail on us, and he would have to say at the last minute, I can't do it. And I appreciate that.
Yeah,
I don't. We don't want somebody to commit, and then he gets a week of film score sessions that he can't really turn down, and he has to call us and say, hey, let's reschedule. So, but in reality, he's the only person that's told me no.
So you've not had a situation where you ask somebody and they say, well, it's only a 2-year college, so I don't know, I'm pretty busy, I don't think I want to do that.
I've never had that experience.
Yeah, okay.
And again, I reach out to people that either I know or that know people that have worked with us, and so that our reputation is out there enough to have people realize that it's not going to be a bad experience. It's going to be it's going to be a quality experience. I've been very fortunate. Again, when you reach out to people you know, it's a little different than calling. Like if I was to call Joe Alessi, I don't know Joe. Joe doesn't know me. It might be a little different. Or Chris Martin,
But on the other hand, I would think that if you're going to call Joe or Chris Martin, Larry Zalkin has played with you and raves about the program there, that Larry could contact Joe, or Tom Hooton could contact Chris, and you could do it that way. Yep. It seems like
absolutely.
The music world in a certain way is quite small.
Oh, for sure. And a lot of ways that has.
Yeah.
That has done that, and that's how I got, even though he wasn't available, that's how I got Dan Higgins' information through Bill Reichenbach, who's written five pieces for us.
Wow.
And been a guest soloist 3 times, I think. So and I'm excited he wrote a piece for us last year. We didn't get to program it, but he wrote a piece for brass quintet and wind ensemble. So we'll program that next October. Wow. Using our faculty brass quintet.
Great.
And it's a terrific piece. So he's been a great resource for us over the years. I should have that information for you. 25
really?
Something,
that maybe. Many?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, tell me if I'm wrong. To me, that seems like that would be even more than a four-year college, a major four-year college.
Some four-year universities do many more. But I would say, yeah, probably. It's just, I started years and years ago with it, and it just was something that I just enjoy doing. And I will tell you, as a conductor, you grow so much, and the ensemble grows so much when you're doing a piece that's never been performed before. I've done at least a dozen just here at RCC, and then I've been part of another dozen or so consortiums that we've done, some West Coast premieres. But I've done maybe 15 actual world premieres from different composers. Like I said, four from Bill. We have two faculty composers. One has written four pieces for us, and then the other has written two pieces for our symphonic band. I haven't done. Oh no, I did do a premiere from Steve Maupar. So we have two Steve theorists. Steve Maupar and Stephen Schmidt are both composers here on faculty full time. So I've done that, and then. So I would say 25 or 30 total over the years. Some years more and some years less. But this, we did one in December of this academic year, and then, of course, yours just this last March. So we did two this year. And I just didn't get a chance to do Bill's piece. But that's, I have Bill's piece, and I have another Stephen Schmidt piece that is... to program for next year.
So the other thing that amazed me was your hall being sold out and having literally people standing. The aisles were filled from the front to the back of the hall. And I think my impression, tell me if I'm wrong, but my impression is that most college wind ensembles, the hall, if it's a good crowd, is maybe half filled. Is that correct?
I don't know. It depends on the event, uh-huh. And it depends on the size of the hall, probably.
Yeah, that's true.
So our hall only seats 460. So that's a perfect size for most of our concerts. We did, you know. So I'll tell you, and I know I shared this secret with you, but
yeah,
I have kind of a formula for building an audience. That concert and the concert coming up in May, we split the concert with an honor band, a high school honor band in 10th, 11th, 12th grade honor band in March, and then a 7th, 8th, and 9th grade honor band in May. And so we host that honor band. So we had 300 high school students, well, 10th, 11th, 12th grade students, audition for this honor ensemble. And out of that almost 300, I selected 85. And so 85 students from probably 35 different high schools, and they bring their parents and their friends and their family members, along with my ensemble's parents and friends and family members. We can get up into that 400 audience members pretty fast. And then you add the actual performers. So my wind ensemble is, I think, about 55 players, and then you have, 85 members of the high school ensemble. So those were the people standing in the aisles, so that we didn't take the seats away from the actual patrons. But that's that, like I said, that's kind of a built-in formula that I started, and it helps build the audience. And then again, at $10 a ticket, it helps fund projects like this.
Yeah. Do you think a four-year college could do that? Where they would have the second half be an honor band?
Many of them do, yeah. I know, or they have, I wouldn't say every concert, because and the only drawback from that is you limit the amount of music that you can perform so on that concert. So when we do things like that, we'll do multiple concerts, and we'll do concerts with just us, and the audience certainly isn't as large. So when I split the concert, I can only do 40 minutes or 45 minutes worth of music. Whereas if I have a full concert, then I could program an hour 15 of actual music with intermission. So that's the only drawback.
And you've been, I would think, like if you had, you said 300 people audition, are those individual auditions that you will have to hear?
Last year, we, you know, obviously we didn't do this ensemble through COVID and coming out of COVID. So last year was the first year we tried to bring it back. And I tried to, well, I did. I listened to all of them last year, and that was a mistake. So this year, I took my principal players from the wind ensemble, and I had them listen to all the different instruments. And I listened to a few here or there, and then I would spot check what they were doing. And so I let them do most of the work, and they enjoyed it, and it gave me a little bit of a break. Because, yeah, listening to 300 auditions is a little bit too much.
Yeah, but even so, I would imagine your work schedule, to have the program that you have, you're pretty busy a lot of the time.
Yeah. This time of year, I'm working pretty much all day, every day. So, but we're on spring break right now, so I have a chance to relax.
Yeah, that's good. But even like on Saturday, some of the times you're doing honor bands or jazz ensembles or things like that.
Yeah, like I said, the spring semester is very busy. That's when we do all of our recruiting events. And as much as it was a great experience to have a full audience for our concert, in reality, it's all in an effort to recruit and to help build the program and sustain the program.
Yeah. Yeah, so honor bands are probably a great way to recruit.
Absolutely. So we do a couple of events like that. So the honor bands, and then we host a couple of festivals. So for those of us that aren't familiar with the format, is we invite groups to perform pretty much every half hour on the half hour, and then we bring in clinician and adjudicators, and the student ensembles will perform on the stage. They will receive audio comments from two or three or four judges / clinicians. And then in our format, then they will go into, after the performance, they will go into another room, and one of the clinicians that just heard them will work with them for 20 minutes or so based on their performance. And it's a super great learning experience for everybody. We don't do in the wind ensemble and the symphony orchestra festivals, we don't do numbers or ratings or anything. It's just completely comments only and performance. And because I reach out and I try to get the best clinicians I can, and they get a chance to play in our beautiful hall, which most of them don't have that experience at their own campus. They play at in a cafeteria maybe, or the gymnasium, or a multi-purpose hall that doesn't sound as, you know, as great as it should or it could. And so so we do those. And again, it's a recruiting. I mean, it's nice to do that, but get them on campus, get their parents to see our facility. And then we usually have the wind ensemble play during the lunch hour. So they get to hear our ensemble and the great things that our students are doing. And so it's kind of an all-in-one package that they get to. So our belief, and it's not just mine, my colleagues work very hard as well, that if we can get people on campus, the more people we get on campus, the better it is for us.
You sure sound like you must be very, very organized.
I think I'd have to be. Yeah. I don't think I could do. I don't know where I learned it, but I'm pretty organized. I have a list. Every morning when I get to work, I look at my list. Well, actually, every day that I leave, I put my list together of what's going to happen tomorrow. And then when I get to work, I have my list. And sometimes it just evolves. Some things at the kind of towards the top of the list, some of them never get to the top of the list for a long time if they're not super prioritized. And some things like, oh my gosh, this has the deadline, so I have to move this right at the top. I have to take care of this. And again, that's for me, that's one of the reasons I like being in my office early, because I can get a lot of work done between 7:30 and 8:30 or whatever, when I'm just sitting in my office and I don't have to worry about prepping for a class yet, or I don't have students asking me, you know, they usually don't get there that early.
Yeah.
So let's go way back then. Are you originally from California?
Yes, I grew up in Covina, which is about 30 miles east of LA. And I went to, we lived there. We moved there in 1975. We came down from the Bay Area. My dad drove for Greyhound Bus when I was young. And so he got furloughed a bunch. So we moved a lot from, I think I went to 3 first grades. And then we ended up in the Bay Area for a while, and then he got reassigned to work in LA. So they ended up in Covina, and that's where I grew up. So grew up in Covina, California, Southern California, my whole life.
And you started with trumpet and then got into conducting?
Yeah, I there was a terrific trumpet teacher in the Glendora area, which is the next city north of us, named David Evans.
I thought you were going to say that name. Yeah, he taught a lot of really great people who were just beginning.
Yeah, and so I was so fortunate to start studying with him in the 7th grade. Unfortunately, we lost. He passed away just a year or two ago. But the foundation, he taught so many young players and advanced players too. But he had a knack for, and that's what he did. He taught middle school, but as soon as he was done teaching, he came home and he had trumpet students from 5 o'clock to 8:30 every day. He had quite a studio. So I studied with him starting in 7th grade, like I said, and I saw him every other week all the way through high school. And then I received a scholarship to attend Cal State Fullerton, and he was the trumpet teacher there. Uh-huh. And so I studied with him through my junior year of college. And then that year they hired Malcolm McNabb to teach trumpet at Cal State Fullerton. And so I was fortunate enough to study with Malcolm McNabb for the 2 years of my remaining undergraduate and then graduate school. So I studied with Malcolm for...
Right. And you're still good friends with Malcolm, I think, right?
Yeah. We've been able to keep in touch. And we host his... RCC, Riverside City College, hosts his summer Camp McNabb. It's a 4-day trumpet camp. And so we host that. And I try to call him when I can and check up on him and see how he's doing. But he still plays great, and he's continues to be a big influence on me and my trumpet playing.
And when did you get the conducting bug? Was that in college or before?
Yeah, I was asked to teach at a summer camp. There was this fabulous summer camp at Cal State Fullerton called the California Music Academy. In the mid to late, I guess mid 80s through the late 90s. Well, they started, Benton Miner, who was the director of bands at Cal State Fullerton, started the camp, I think, in the 70s. And it was a great model where he would bring in guest conductors, but the undergraduates were the instrumental coaches. And so as a freshman, he asked me to teach trumpet that summer. And then he asked me if I wanted to conduct the 3rd jazz ensemble. And of course I said yes. And so I started getting into teaching then. And then I gradually started conducting the second concert band at the camp. And then just got the bug of conducting. And I just loved working with students. And then I took a job playing in a brass ensemble in Japan for an entire year.
Really?
Right after my undergraduate, after I graduated from undergraduate school, and I was just playing trumpet. I was loving it. I was playing a lot at Disneyland. I was doing a lot of musical theater shows. I had 6 or 7 accounts with musical theaters. Many of those theaters have closed now, unfortunately. But so I was ready to go out and find a high school teaching job, but I was playing enough that I was like, I'm going to do this for a little bit longer. And this opportunity came up for me to play in a brass ensemble in Japan. So I went to Japan for a year And then I came home, and of course, being gone for a year, all of your contacts are gone.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh boy, what do I do? Luckily, I had saved some money from the Japan job. And my undergraduate mentor, Mitch Fennell, said, well, why don't you do a master's degree in conducting? And I said, okay, sure. So I started my master's degree in conducting, and that's when I really fell in love with conducting. He is an amazing musician, mentor, now super good friend. But he really inspired me to be a conductor and said, you should try this. And then I just lucked out. I just happened to be at the right place at the right time. And as I was finishing my master's degree, the job at Riverside City College opened, and I got it. And so that was 1995.
Did you have to audition for that job? And if you did, what was it like?
It was an interview. We had to teach a small theory lesson for undergraduate first semester theory. And then we had to conduct the ensemble. And at that time, the ensemble was not very large. The program wasn't at nearly as robust as it is now when I took it over in 1995. The faculty was really small. The student body wasn't as big. And it was certainly a work in progress to build the program when I first got there.
Mm-hmm. So you conducted and you taught a theory class, and was that it? And did you have a meeting with the professors where they ask you questions?
Yeah. It was a pretty intense interview process, like any other faculty position. They asked you what your experiences were and why you would be a good fit and what could you bring to the college and all of that. So, but again, I think it just happened to be, I don't know, it certainly would not be the same pool as if I was to retire today and somebody, they would advertise my current job. I think they would get a lot of applicants.
Yeah.
Because of the program that is now there. But I just don't think that the demand for somebody to take that job in 1995 was what it would be, certainly not what it would be if we were advertising today. Yeah. For the same job.
And was the position just a conductor of the wind ensemble and trumpet teacher?
So it was even more general than that. My because the faculty was so small, my first semester I taught trumpet, I conducted the wind ensemble, I taught beginning theory, and I think I taught first semester jazz improvisation. So that was my first assignment. And then I think the second semester I taught a section or two of music appreciation for non-majors. My current position now is wind ensemble conductor. I teach a few trumpet students, but I'm also department chair. So that takes a lot of my time. And then I teach a history of film music class,
which is okay.
So much fun. Yeah.
Do you have film composers come and talk?
No, I don't. This class I teach completely online. It's completely asynchronous. So, but I haven't had a chance to, and I really don't know that many film composers. So I wouldn't have that resource. I probably could. I just haven't reached out.
Yeah. Well, going back to your first year, did you have ideas about how you wanted to build the program, and were you thinking of ending up where you are now, or was it just, I'll try this first year and I'll do the best job I can and we'll see what happens?
I think it was part of that. I think it was, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? It was my first job other than playing trumpet. So I had amazing support. My colleague that I, my colleagues are great. But I have one specific colleague that is our director of jazz studies. His name is Charlie Richard. I couldn't ask for a better colleague. And he had already been at the college for a couple of years. And he was a graduate of Riverside City College. Amazing musician. And so he helped me with all the beginning professor things. And we had back then, and sadly we don't do it anymore. But back then we had a really great new faculty orientation. Every Friday afternoon, the new faculty would sit with mentor teachers and administrators, and we would learn about the college, and we'd learn about the student body, and we'd learn about teaching techniques and things like that. And we don't do that anymore. So we've certainly grown a lot since 1995, not just in the music department, but the college in general. And so that's one of the things that have kind of fallen out of touch.
What were the steps then when after your first year that you took that got you to where you are now in terms of like you're chairman of the department? When did that happen? And were you like an assistant chairman or whatever it would be called before that? Or was it just one big leap?
I'm pretty sure Charlie Richard was the chair. And I think around 2000, maybe 99, he and his wife started a family, and we were having lunch one day, and he said, you know, I kind of want to spend more time at home. Do you have any interest of being chair? And I said, sure, whatever, whatever you need.
Whatever.
And so, yeah, I mean, it was literally like he wanted to, you know, he wanted to spend more time with his family because he just had a baby. And I was like, sure, I'll do whatever you need, whatever we need to do, I'll do. So I became chair. And I was chair for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. And then we had somebody else take over for 2 years. And then Charlie became chair again. And then, I don't know, about 10 years ago, he became an interim dean. And so by default, he couldn't be chair. And so I became chair then. And then he only did 1 year as interim dean. He didn't want to continue being the dean. So he came back to faculty. And being a year in administration as a dean, he decided I just want to teach. I don't want to be chair. I don't want to do. I'll do all my institutional service, and I'll be on committees, but I don't want to really be chair. So I've been chair, and I keep getting reelected. So
boy, and the workload is that really tough, or is it doable?
It isn't. I mean, it's tough, but I have amazing faculty that are very reasonable, and so it makes my job. It makes my life very easy.
Uh-huh, okay.
I try really hard not to micromanage. So I try to tell my faculty, I'm here to support you. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm not their boss by any means. So when it comes to anything with our program, I let them run the show, and I'm just there to help them if they need resources or if they need facilities or anything like that. I'm just kind of there to help. So, and it's interesting the way our department is divided. I don't want to say divided, but it is divided by each faculty member has kind of a group that they're in charge of. So like for me, I was hired as the wind ensemble conductor. Charlie runs the jazz studies department. John Byan runs the choral department. Peter Curtis runs the guitar department. Yasmika Connect runs the piano department. James Rossio runs the marching band and also does the concert band and one of the jazz ensembles. And then Steve Schmidt and Steve Mopar are our theory professors. So everybody has their little pocket. And then we have a music Jennifer Amaya runs our music technology program. So we all have our duties. And even though we all collaborate, we all have our own budgets. We all have our own resources, and our, you know, so it's, you know, it's not like we're all teaching the same course. We're, you know, we all have our specialized our emphasis.
Right.
So it makes it a little easier that way. But I try to stay out of their way, and if I can help, I'm there to help. But as a chair, it's really easy when you have amazing faculty that do all the work and you're just there to assist them.
Yeah. And if, for example, if let's say if a theory student, for example, or somebody who's in a jazz band, if they are, let's say, a discipline problem, that's sort of a general idea, you don't handle that at all. It's just the theory professor or the jazz man.
You know, technically, if there's a real big discipline problem, and we haven't had many at all, we have a next level of administration would be our dean of student services. That would be the person that would that would deal with any kind of discipline or any issues like that. So we would send them on to the next level. I would get involved just to get the dean involved, but it's I really don't have to deal with that.
Well, in addition to conducting the wind ensemble, you also have conducted the orchestra there, and also don't you do jazz ensemble some of the times, or jazz band? You call it dance band or jazz band? Jazz ensemble.
We call it jazz ensemble. We have six jazz ensembles.
Wow.
At Riverside City College.
Is that normal?
No. No. Actually, we have seven. I think. Yeah, we have three. One, two, three. We have three. We have four student ensembles, and then we have on Monday night we have a faculty and community ensemble. And then we have a community ensemble on Tuesday and Wednesday nights. So, and I play lead trumpet in the Monday evening jazz ensemble. And yeah, for 20 years I conducted the orchestra. And then, interesting enough, when we went all remote for COVID, the string program got hit the hardest. We worked very hard as a department to desperately try to figure out how to get the students involved in remote instruction. And we were meeting weekly as faculty saying, okay, what worked? What didn't work? And to try this and, oh my gosh, what do I do? And because we worked collectively and very diligently, I think that's one of the reasons that we were able to come back as fast as we came back. But going back to the orchestra, for some reason, the string students, they just disappeared. So when we came back to in-person rehearsals, we had one string player. So we didn't offer the orchestra that year. And I took that opportunity to say, you know what, I'm kind of doing too much, so I'm gonna step down. And then I found somebody very talented, conductor, to help build the program back up, and he's doing a wonderful job. His name is Gene Moon, and he's doing an excellent job with our orchestra. But that gave me an opportunity to take one thing off of my plate, because I'm not good at that. I'm good at adding things to my plate, but I'm not very good about taking things off my plate. So, that was a big step for me. But I did conduct the orchestra for 20 years.
Yeah. Wow. So thinking of like a jazz band or jazz ensembles, I should say, orchestras and wind ensembles, is there sort of a different mentality of the students with each group?
I hope not. I don't think so. I think most of them are all in all of the groups. We encourage the students to play in as many groups as they possibly can. And we have a philosophy in the instrumental. Well, we're all on the same page, which is another great thing about my colleagues, is that we try to teach the instrument first, and we try to teach the classical side of the instrument first. And then if they want to learn jazz, then great. We're there to help them too, but we want them to have great fundamentals on their instrument first, and then we can teach them the style and different things. But I don't. There is at our institution, there really is no difference in attitude or anything between. We don't have like the jazzers or the orchestra players. I mean, we have people that play all of the ensembles.
Join us in part two, where Tony and Kevin discuss some of Kevin's inspirations and mentors, Dave Evans, Malcolm McNabb, and Bobby Shue for trumpet, and Professor Jerry Junkin for conducting, specifically talking about the four straight years that Kevin attended a life-changing conducting workshop in Texas. Tony then asks Kevin one of his favorite questions, what makes a great student? They end with a story about a concert where Carl Hus's Music for Prague 1968 was performed, and the emotional and powerful impact that piece had. To hear the second portion of Tony and Kevin's conversation, please consider becoming a contributing listener by clicking on the big blue button on the podcast website to start a free trial. You can also go directly to anthonyplogue-on-music, supercast.com. As a contributor, you'll be able to listen to additional audio content and study up on Tony's podcast Reflections, where he does a recap of his interviews focusing on suggestions for students. You'll also have access to our Discord server, where you can join an ongoing discussion while meeting and sharing ideas with other listeners. Thank you for listening in, and be sure to help us spread the word.